Jonathan hosting for Bagel Tech Photo is provided by UK2.net. Web hosting for everyone.
Hello all, and welcome to this week's episode of Bagel Tech Photo. I'm your host, Kyle Swagger, as always, and we got a nice show for you this week. We got something a little different this week, and it took us a while to get going, but once I got the go from Ewan, go.
I screwed up last week, so you screwed up this week, so we need Alex next week, and Chris can have the week after.
Oh, I'm sure we can manage it.
Oh, no, sure, we'll just screw up.
Let's just get that all in writing, that way everybody knows when to screw up and which day and which week, so... as I was saying, we got a great show for you for this week. We've got a new guy in, Chris. I didn't catch your last name, Chris.
I'm Chris Forsman. Hello from Chicago, Illinois.
Bright and early.
Mm-hmm.
15 after 5 there in the morning?
That's great.
Chris will be wearing a hat throughout the entire show as he comes on each week because it's too early to do his hair.
It's the perfect thing, actually. Yeah. Now, are you wearing it backwards or frontwards? Because right now, my video's just crapped out, so I can't even see you.
Brian Johnson style.
Oh, Brian forwards. Johnson style.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the perfect style at 5:15 a.m.
That's what I thought.
It depends if you're coming home or getting up.
It's also why I reek of bourbon.
Good man. So, Chris,
so you never went to bed?
Oh, yeah, I went to bed.
You could have kept the myth running for a bit longer there, dude.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Chris. Tell us what you do, how you got into photography. Give us a little background on you.
Sure. I'll try to be brief, but I got into photography in eighth grade with a purchase of a 110 camera at a drugstore. So since about age 13 and in high school, I took photography courses, and college, I took photography courses, did freelance work, worked at a camera shop, taught some classes at a museum, eventually got up to teaching at college level. So I'm mired in photo nerdiness.
Good man. I started with a 110 as well, mate, so you'll do. I got it for learning to tie my shoelaces by myself.
Yeah. I spent the first money with the first job I ever had.
Oh, good man.
To buy that camera. Oh, yeah. I was so happy.
This is the passion. This is what it. You love. This is.
If you're a photographer, you're always broke because of all the crap you buy.
Right.
Same as a musician.
Is that why?
Always broke.
You never make any money.
Well, for me, it's cool hats and bourbon. And photography.
Yeah, I mean, if every photographer could get by on a 110, then we'd all be millionaires. We make a fortune, but we spend it. That's the trouble.
Tell me about it.
And now you're writing for Ars Technica, correct?
Yeah, in 2008, I decided to take some time off from studying computer engineering because photography is not really enough. Ever is it. And so yeah, I started writing for Ars Technica in early 2008, and I've been a contributing writer ever since.
Good man.
Sweet deal.
And we used your article last week, like I said, so the conversation on 12 megapixels last week was all down to Chris.
Yes, and we're going to stretch that a bit today, and we'll get that to in a moment. The guy you hear talking there, we all know him, we all love him, sometimes hate him, but
Go, it's Ewan.
Bah humbug.
Mr. Ewan Rankin. How are you, Ewan? Stranger?
I'm all right, I'm all right.
I'm the stranger, actually.
Do you know what? I've realized this week how addicted I am to Twitter and internet and stuff, because I've been out of the range of internet decent connection for pretty much Tuesday afternoon onwards up until last night when I got back in to do the big show. So I was catching up on the stories.
You didn't tell me you were in the Philippines.
Yeah, it might as well have been, mate. I had my Wi-Fi dongle, my Wi-Fi going on, and I had point five down was the best I got in the area that I was at. So things were 140 characters was taking an awful long time.
Well, it's nice to know that you've made it back to civilization.
I'm back at 50 megabits a second and loving it.
Yeah, I hate you too. Also with us as always is Alex G. Fox. Alex, what have you been up to this week?
I'm up to 100 megabits. No, what have I been doing?
I doubly hate you, just so you know.
You Europeans with your great broadband.
Yeah, it's a curse.
Not a lot. I just did some work. And I've been playing with one of my old scanners because I was about to throw it in the bin. I thought, you know what? If I turn it on, it might be more useful.
Scanner, so, does it still have the SCSI port?
No, this one, you know what? I only just realized.
No, it's parallel, I heard.
Parallel.
I only just realized it was FireWire.
Oh, it's FireWire.
400.
The most updated version.
400, though.
Yeah, oh, yeah, of course, 400.
What were you scanning?
I had a pile of transparencies that I was going to throw away because I couldn't be bothered to get them scanned. And I thought, you know what? I could do it myself.
You thought, you lazy bastard.
Yeah, that's sort of where it got to.
Okay.
Well, we were talking about working on a budget. That's a budget.
Alex's cheap thingy this week is do it yourself.
Yeah, don't throw away a £5,000 scanner just because you can't be bothered to turn it on. Yeah.
But when you throw it away, I'll have it.
Oh, I've got some in the loft you can have. But they are SCSI.
No, okay. Can't help me then.
Oh. I've got a USB zip drive I can send you just in case you need to back them up.
Oh, God.
Oh, cool. I've actually got some zip disks right over here in the cupboard. You can have those too, Alex. You can get right up and caught up on technology.
A massive 700 megabytes.
Yeah, or an old CD. Your choice.
Moving on.
Yes.
Oh, yes, please. The week in photography. One thing I actually want to jump into, guys, I'm going to get all your thoughts about it. Of course, we were talking about Chris's article, 12 pixels is enough. We kind of went through that last week.
Your breath smells.
Yeah, 12 pickles is enough for anyone.
12 megapixels.
You know, I can't terminate this connection anytime, guys.
I thought that was automatic.
Yeah, it is automatic, actually, yeah, thanks to my ISP. Now, Hasselblad this week is coming out what they say is a 200 megapixel camera. Now, I know none of us can afford it except the China-made Hasselhoff version, which I'm having shipped from Hongshu very shortly. But other than that, where did this thing come from? And after saying 12 is only enough, or is enough, should I say, do we really need this or do we just want this? I'll start with Chris. What about you? Have you seen this article this week?
I did look into it briefly. I guess it uses an interesting technique where it shifts the CCD and takes a series of pictures and then kind of weaves them all together to achieve this high resolution. We don't need it. We don't need it. We just want it. You know, I mean, nobody needs a 400 horsepower car, but we sure like them.
Yeah. That's the truth. I mean,
they're a lot of fun to drive. Nobody needs that.
Well, we always talk about this is porn for photographers, really. I mean, that's what you always say, Ewan. I mean, obviously something you want, but no way in hell. Should we just say that?
I mean, this is like I said, it's like bringing home a supermodel to live with you and your wife. You know, it's expensive to run.
How dare you cheat on your Canon?
Your wife hates you for having it. But it's one of those things. There's a certain thing about Hasselblad that, you know, that's the camera that went to the moon. You know, there's a porn element to it. It is porn. It's pure pornography. And there are certain people who would use this and get an awful lot from it. And I would as well in a lot of circumstances. I mean, I do a lot of technical photography where I shoot large voids. And to be able to shoot something at 200 megapixels and then be able to have an image that I can crop infinitely almost to show up detail within the machinery that I've shot, that'd be really good, actually. Whether people are going to pay me, you know, £4,000 a day in order to be able to recover the costs of this camera for it, I'm not sure. But I think if you talked about general photography, I'd use this and I would salivate at it and I'd push the wife into the spare room and put it in the bed next to me quite happily. But the trouble is, after about 2 weeks, I'd probably go back to my Canon. Because it'd be just it'd be too much trouble processing the images at 200 megapixels, mate.
It's because the Canon gets up in the morning and makes you eggs and bacon, doesn't
it? No, that's the wife. About? No. No, I mean, the thing with this is, you know, in terms of using it, it'd be great. It would look fantastic. There'd be stunning images. But at 99% of what I do, 200 megapixels is going to take more processing time on my computer than I've got to wait for the damn thing to even open. You know, no one's sitting thinking about the transfer rates of the data on this thing. You know, is there a burst mode? I don't think so.
Does it have a Thunderbolt port?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, getting the data off it, you know, what flash card's going to take two images and then you've got to change it.
And you've got to keep in mind that it's using multiple exposures to achieve that resolution. I mean, you're not going to be able to shoot a moving subject with this camera.
No.
Alex, what do you think, Mr. Nikon man?
Yeah, I for what I do, it would be, no, I don't even know if it'd be useful, but I could use it because I shoot static objects. But 50 megapixels would do me fine, thanks. And if I wanted to go up to anything like that, I'd use a scanning back. Because a scanning back, you can, 200 megapixels is nothing for a scanning back. It takes a few minutes to take a picture.
You're in a scanning mood this week.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, this scanner I was using, what it does multiple exposures on a single scan, where it scans it, say, up to 8 times, and it does a different exposure for each scan. So you get a different definition of the blacks and the grays and the various things that make up the shadows when you scan it. So you get a far, far sharper scan, and you bring a lot more detail out of what you're scanning, out of the transparency, which is exactly what this camera's doing. It's taking four identical shots with four different exposures, and it's molding them together. So to call it a 200 megapixel camera is disingenuous, to say the least. What it is, it's exactly the same camera as they had. And it's funny because Ewan used the word, does it have a burst mode? Well, yes, it does. It has a four-shot burst mode, automatic, to put it together. So, you know, slightly 200 megapixels is a myth. But, you know, with a Hasselblad, what you're getting is you're getting the best sensor on the market. And more importantly, you're getting the best glass on the market. Now, you could have the best sensor in the world and stick on a Sigma £500 lens on the end of it, and it's going to look rubbish. So remembering with the Hasselblad, what you're getting the best lenses.
We'd just like to apologise to Sigma there if they're offended by that remark. But
yes, well, they didn't give me anything for nothing. So
yeah, but we do need you as a sponsor, Sigma. Thank you very much.
Yes, exactly. But I was just saying, so you know, the idea is great. But if I was going to use something like that, I'd use a scanning back that costs £8,000, and it would do the job even better.
But scanning backs work far better.
Scanning backs.
Facts. Yeah. I was going to ask about the sensor, though. I mean, we're talking about the sensor now and how great the sensor is. I mean, heck, for if you got an old Hasselblad just laying around, you can upgrade it for $10,000.
Yeah. You've got to remember, with a Hasselblad, you've got 50 megapixels, right? And you've got it on a sensor which is more than four times the size of, say, the top-of-the-range Nikon or top-of-the-range Canon. So, in fact, if you had the top-of-the-range Nikon, what's that, 24 megapixels, you'd get more than 50 megapixels if you stuck four of them together. So what they've actually done, they've actually, you know, put the pixels slightly further apart, and so they're giving you a better quality rather than cramming them in together. And so in a funny way, they've taken something that's absolutely superior and they've buggered it up a bit. So I'm not that amazingly impressed.
hard to impress, I can tell.
But if they want to send me one, I'll try it out.
Go on, Chris. You had an actual point to make. Go ahead.
A point to make. Well, you were talking about earlier that, I think Ewan was talking about earlier that if he had the camera, he would have some applications for it. You know, he named some specific scenarios where it would be useful, and that's not to say that there aren't photographers who could use 200 megapixels for whatever application they're doing. And if you look back at my article, I don't say no one can use more than 12 megapixels. I say most people.
Yeah, no,
Average photographer, I mean, even at 12 megapixels, honestly, I would say maybe 90% of what I shoot, I bump the resolution down to small on my Canon, and even then I size that down. You know, so 12 megapixels to me just seems like an egregious waste. Sometimes.
Can I just add one more point? I'm just thinking about this literally, and I've got two film Hasselblads, and you
just want to rub it in.
No, the point is quite simply, you're talking about 200 megapixels. Well, why don't you just shoot it on film?
Yeah, scan it. Because the amount of time you're going to spend is probably equal.
Scan it.
Yeah, but that's the point, isn't it? You can spend £40,000 on or $40,000 on this setup, or you can go and buy yourself a nice 5.4 for £1,000 and a bit of film and a couple of plates, and you'll get the equivalent of a 1,000 megapixels. That's work it out.
No, the money's probably a contractor for a year to do the scanning for you manually. You can hire a person.
No, it's just the point. It just shows you that when you get to this high end, just use film.
Agree.
Well, we've talked about it a million times on this show about how no matter Blu-ray or if it's how many megapixels or how great the digital camera is, the results always seem to be better in film. And, I always go back to it. Ewan always disagrees with me on this. I still think vinyl sounds better than compact disc. And in a sense, analog still seems, if you want utmost quality, analog for some reason still seems to be king.
Yeah. But I shoot on 10x8 film, and you stick it in a drum scanner, and you get the standard output is a 5 gigabyte file off a 10x8 drum scan. Mm. You find me a camera that can get anywhere near that.
But you know,
no thanks.
Well, I can say in what you do, Alex, you know that provides a value. But in 90% of even what professionals would do, it doesn't. I mean, Chris's point is valid. You know, last week we did say there's applications where you really do want to go. That I certainly need more than 12 megapixels in what I do. But how often do you need that? Well, you know, Chris has made a good point there again about, well, actually, some of the stuff I do, I shoot for a local newspaper. Well, you know, 2 megapixels, thanks very much, because it's going to be a 2x3 black and white in a newspaper print.
Sure, or you just shoot on film.
Yeah, well, even then I wouldn't do good. Jesus, don't even make me think about going to film and developing it to go in a newspaper at 2x3. Yeah,
don't send Ewan back in the dark room. He doesn't like it there.
I don't. I never did it. I never enjoyed it much when I had it before, so...
I mean, I remember shooting weddings in the 90s and using, like, thinking like 10 rolls of film. Oh my God, it's so many exposures. 360. What am I going to do with all this film? Mm. Those thoughts don't even enter my head.
No, I mean, so I've still got every roll of film I've ever shot as a professional photographer in a bin up in the loft. Even when I fogged it, I keep it, and I don't know why. There's just something about you don't get rid of stuff
because you paid for it already. You might as well keep it.
You're always broke and you hoard everything. That's
right.
That's the characteristics of a pro photographer, I think.
Hoping one day that somehow, some way, they'll be able to melt it down and they can actually reuse it or recycle it.
It's a massive fire risk.
Yeah, but the difference is when we shot on film, we sort of needed to know what we were doing. You know, and that was the difference. There was a lot more skill to it.
Well, you had to get it right, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, if you didn't, then you'd have a pissed off bride or a client or whatever. So
let's move on before we get on to when I was a dinosaur.
It's making T-Rex. A comeback.
Yeah, let's move on because we can't afford this anyways. Let's get down to reality, and that is the Leica compact 14.1 megapixel camera. It's 3D photos and GPS on this thing. Now we're
that's
down
too,
to the
that's too many megapixels. There's 2 million extra megapixels, obviously.
Sorry, really? Say who that
needs, again. Who needs 14 megapixels?
He's going back to his article.
Which story are we doing? Because I'm lost now.
The Leica compact camera boosts.
Thank you.
14.1 megapixels.
I'm sorry. I thought we were doing the Samsung story next.
No. We're going to leave that at the end.
Oh, damn, we're slick. Chris isn't coming back.
I thought I'd bring everybody back to reality and what we can actually afford, and then we can go on to what may happen with Samsung.
If you want to go back to something that everyone can afford, you don't go back to Leica. Jesus.
This beats the hell out of $45,000.
True. Okay, carry on. Sorry, mate. As you were.
Yeah, I don't know. Chris was somewhere. Where were you going, Chris? I'm lost.
No, I'm right here. Right here. Right here. Leica.
Do we like this camera? Do we like this camera? I mean, 460,000 pixels. You know, got a 3-inch touchscreen on the back, so it's very, you know, we're in the touchscreen age now with everything. Everybody likes to touch something. That didn't come out right. But
I'm touching something right now, so.
No.
Don't.
Leave the bourbon alone, dude.
Don't be embarrassed.
It looks like a nice camera. I mean, I'm actually, while I'm digging through the article, I'm trying to find the actual price.
$749.
$749. Okay, so does this move us into the, we talk about the Fuji, I think it's the FinePix that we talked about a few weeks ago. Is this
X100?
Or is this in the, yeah. I think that was it, yeah. And we're, you know, are we talking like that this needs to either come down in price? Is it comparable? Or do we simply just go up to the Nikon that we always talk about, that Alex always brings up, and just go in that direction?
The X100 and this Felix 30 are two entirely different beasts. I mean, the X100, one of its main features that has a fixed lens. It's like it has a giant zoom. I don't feel like it's even a fair comparison.
No, I think the point that Carl's trying to make is, if you've got $1,000 to spend on a compact camera, which one are you going to get? And it's kind of comparative within the range of the fact of price more than functionality. You know, are you saying I'm happy with the fixed lens? I mean, I've got one thing that, you know, I'm as bad as every other photographer at times. I get lazy when I've got the ability to zoom, whereas having a fixed lens, and I do it a lot, I force myself to put a 50mm prime lens on my camera and move myself rather than trying to sit there with a 200mm zoom and try and just go in and out on things that I think look interesting from my point of view. I think with this camera, the thing that sets it apart is $300 cheaper for a start. And I think the other thing that sets it apart is the fact that it's got a great optical zoom, and with Leica, you know, you're going to get great glass and great imaging through it. If you gave me the choice of buying top end Panasonic Lumix with a decent optical zoom on it, 1080p video and 15 megapixels, I think they don't go up that far, but you know, I would buy the Leica money no object, because I know the quality of the image is going to be not significantly higher. The quality of the image is going to be is more reliable. You're going to get less aberrations on the colors, and you're going to get a far clearer image coming through the glass. But that's been a bit snobby.
No option, though.
That's been a bit snobby.
On a budget. You're saying like money, no option. But I mean, how much more is the Leica compared to the Lumix you're talking about? Are we talking hundreds or just?
You're looking at, there's a significantly better build quality here. I'd have to have a play with it to see what the functionality of the software is. I mean, that's usually the thing that kills cameras in the compact range. You know, I like the fact that this has got a dial on the top, but the one thing I love about my Canon G9, for example, is I can select ISO off a roll wheel on the top rather than having to go into the software. You know, I want stuff, but again, this is whether I'm a representation of the market or not, but I want stuff where I can change things with buttons. And it's not me being a dinosaur. I want to do it, and I want to do it quickly.
I would get the feeling, though, this isn't like that. I mean, we're talking touchscreen here. You're talking the upper end prosumer here, wouldn't you say?
Well, you could. You might have like an ISO button on the back image where you look at it and you can just hit that, and there's an instant pull down menu comes up, and you do it on a single stroke. Whereas the Lumix that I've got to go into a sub menu, then I've got to roll down to ISO, then I've got to go into the ISO menu, and then I've got to roll down in that to get what I want. And then I can take a picture, and it really is that long to do it. Whereas with my G9, I spin a wheel, I take a picture, done.
I got you. Yeah, we'll kind of wrap this out. I'm going to get Alex's thought on there. Then we'll get on to everybody's favorite story of the week, which is the Samsung thing. But your personal thoughts on the Leica, Alex?
Well, what I like about this story more than anything is, I think it was Engadget. Is it Engadget? It's definitely Engadget. I like their opening line. It just simply says, you know the drill. Panasonic introduces a perfectly capable camera, and a few months later, Leica tweaks a few angles, paints it black, and slaps an iconic logo on it. And that says it really says it all about this camera, doesn't it? It's, it's a Panasonic with a Leica badge.
And let's not forget, you get a free leather case.
You know, that's worth the extra $500.
Well, right. And if I'm not mistaken, most of the Panasonic versions, don't they also have the Leica lens on it?
Yeah, they have the. It's the same camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I mean, yeah, look, if I had the money, I'd rather walk around with a Leica badge than the Panasonic one.
Oh, yeah, me too.
This is it.
Sure.
This is essentially I got a Ford, but somehow I got a hold of a BMW emblem and I just slapped it right on there.
There you go.
No, okay.
I don't think it's right to say.
Off some people now.
It's more like if Ford made the car, but BMW made the engine.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah.
It's what's driving it. I got you. Well, let's move on to the last story, the one that Ewan thought we were going to next, and that is Samsung might be introducing its first medium format digital camera. We're talking probably trying to compete with the likes of Nikon, Canon. Interesting. Alex says, we were talking before the show, Alex says we need it. What say you, Ewan? I mean, what's your thoughts? Does this need to happen, or does Samsung simply belong in the, shall we say, the consumer end of the market?
Yeah, I mean, we always sit and talk about bridge cameras here between the pro and the consumer, from the compact through to the DSLR and you know, things like the G2, G3 Lumixes. One gulf that there is between DSLR and medium format cameras. It's a gulf in price, and it's a gulf in functionality and use. I wouldn't go to a medium format camera because the price jump is just too big to justify it to myself, and mostly to justify it to my wife. So I think that if Samsung came out with something and they didn't take the piss out of people by charging, you know, £15,000 for it, then I think it would be great, really, really great. I would love to see this happen. And you're going to ask me in a minute what price I'd pay. If you were talking about me paying $3,000 or $4,000 for something like this, I'd take their hand off. If you're talking about they're going to charge me $8,000 to $10,000, I'm getting a bit more dubious. I mean, I think you've got to be careful that this is, you know, if you're going to pitch this, I'm sitting trying to think of like the pro end of Canon and Nikon. You're talking about spending £6,000 on those cameras, $8,000. If this is pitching in at that level, it's a tough choice. If it's cheaper than that, it's a no-brainer for me.
Chris, you're a Canon user, right, Chris?
Mm-hmm.
Is Samsung, say they're putting out the equivalent camera they're using right now, possibly even better, not knowing that Samsung is, or shall we say, knowing that Samsung is more based towards the prosumer or even just consumer market,
mm-hmm.
does the name make you shy away? Does it make you think they couldn't possibly do what Canon's doing? They couldn't possibly do what Nikon's doing? I mean, would this be something that you would possibly go towards too? If the price is right, or if the price is over, forget it.
Yeah, I think I agree that I'd probably be, if it's around $3,000 to $4,000, I'd definitely be more interested in trying it out. We're talking about, there are already a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot, but there are actually several choices in a medium format style digital SLR. So, I don't think it would make sense for Samsung to enter that market and coming in at the same kind of price range. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. Mm. I mean, you're already competing for a really small slice of the market at that point anyway. So I think, you know, again, not to say that Samsung doesn't make good cameras, but like you said, they don't really target professionals with their cameras either. So to kind of like basically come in and say, we're going to make this super high end, really expensive medium format camera, you know, with the name Samsung that you would have never considered before, it doesn't seem like it makes a lot of marketing sense to just jump in and be like, here's our $10,000 medium format camera.
I personally feel like, I'll get to you in a second, Alex, but I personally feel like we're falling into the Sony market thing here. The problem is with Sony, it seems like they're overcharging for a lot of things. Yeah, they make great cameras, but you've got the Sony sitting there, and then you've got a Nikon sitting there, and what? It's $50, it's $100 price difference. You know Nikon, you trust Nikon. Wouldn't you rather go there? I mean, is that how you see it, Alex, or... Or is it something you say, because you said before, we need competition in this market.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was just flicking through and quickly looking, right? The number one probably reasonably priced model is Pentax. Mm-hmm. Pentax makes some really nice medium format digital cameras, but they still come in, I mean, I'm talking in pounds, the very basic body, nothing else, comes in between £9,000 and £10,000. I would say in dollars, sort of $14,000 to $16,000. You know, and that's just, that's a starting point. Now, what I would say about Samsung is there's a usefulness about this type of camera, which is great, but we need another market for this, e.g. a budget version. You know, a budget version. Don't make it that you need to buy medium format lenses. Make it that you can use normal 35mm type lenses. The camera is structured in a certain way that all the differences is you're going to have a medium format back on, if you like, a 35mm lens. I think Leica do something similar. They do a very high-end, it looks like a 35mm camera, but it's actually a medium format size back. Yeah, obviously Leica do it for $20,000 or something.
It's the S system.
Yeah. And yeah. I just think someone needs, for our benefit, maybe not even for theirs, but I would like to see someone come into this market and shake it up. Because there's a lot of photography that you can do, which isn't fast and furious, needing a really fast lens, needing a really fast camera. Lots of portrait photography would really benefit from medium format.
Mm.
But it seems not at those prices.
It seems like what you mean by shake it up, it seems like we're all coming back to around to, yeah, I'll lean towards it a little bit more if the price is actually, you know, don't charge me what I'm going to pay for a Nikon. You got to come way below that before I'm even interested in your brand, because let's face it, you haven't been here before.
I think what's interesting is if you look in Ars Technica, there's a on the story on not Ars Technica, if you look on the story on Engadget, there's a hyperlink off the medium format. You click on that and it takes you to all the medium format stories that they've run on Ars Technica for the last on our Engadget for the last couple of years, and it's all Hasselblad Leaf, Hasselblad Mamiya, Hasselblad Mamiya Phase One,
Microsoft
yeah, Pentax is M30, and you know there's a lot, a big focus on that, and there isn't one camera on there that's going to come in at less than 10k, and that's the real issue. Now the only other problem that you've got, I agree with Alex there, you'd love a medium format back end that would take a 35mm lens front end. I mean that would kill the market. Whoever brought that out would have.
If Nikon did that tomorrow, they'd win it.
It'd be done, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. Whoever makes this leap and gets a series of lenses out there that are very doable with a medium format back is going to clean up. But
there's a technical problem, though, because the image circle from a 35mm lens isn't necessarily going to cover all medium format sensors.
No.
No, but if they do away with this, is another point for the mirrorless technology.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that is where I think you can make it work.
That's what I was about to ask. Would that be somewhere where software would take over in that case?
Yeah, but I think, let me just finish off what I'm saying. The other cautionary note with this story is the fact that you've seen a picture there of a box and you're instantly thinking medium format, when actually probably what it is just a packaging idea for a 35mm sensor and 35mm lens. It's just built to look like it's a medium format camera, but actually it probably is just nothing more than a pinhole camera.
Oh, definitely. If you look at it, it had the old film winders on the side. They've just blanked them off.
Exactly.
Go on, Chris. You had something you were going to say?
I was just going to say that that's a good point. It could just be just kind of a more of a styling exercise.
Bit of a marketing bull.
Well, maybe, but it's testing the water, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, let's see if people are actually interested. Because, I mean, let's face it, when Samsung came out, let's use TVs as an example. It wasn't the brand everybody wanted. It was like, oh, yeah, it was that secondary brand. Yeah, it kind of looks good. It's all right. But now it's like the brand that everybody wants. It's the television that you want. LG is another one that kind of comes to mind. Is this the type of market where that can be done? I mean, it's so dominated by Canon. It's so dominated by Nikon. We've seen Sony fail at it pretty much. I mean, I hate saying that because Sony's made some pretty dang good cameras, but as far as penetrating that market, price point, features wise, they just haven't been able to do it. Does Samsung hold the same fate?
Well, Samsung's a big enough company to take a risk.
I'm going to say yeah. I'm going to go with yes.
You want to stick your neck
no,
in?
No, I'll take the yes on that. Yeah, I think that's a good call.
Yeah. Yes. And Alex? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes.
Bloody okay. Hell, agreement. Move on quickly.
questions, guys. Shall we get into the questions?
Let's
do it. We've got three questions this week. First question comes from Robert. He says, hi, gents. Loving the show. Keep up the good work. I was listening to a show a few weeks ago, and Ewan mentioned that he would sharpen something to bring it into focus, and also mentioned that sharpening for printing. I have Photoshop Elements, and I know I have a sharpening command, but I have to admit to not knowing what exactly does or what it does or how it's properly used. Any chance you kind gentlemen could enlighten me? I guess we'll direct that towards you, Ewan, since you are the man sharpening.
Sharpening, when you take something, particularly if you're using very open apertures, f2.8, f1.8, you're getting an awful lot in very quickly. You can sometimes get a softer image out of that, or if you're using zoom lenses at their extreme, you'll get a very soft image as well. And the idea of sharpening is basically you're telling the software to find the edges of the images that you, or the subjects that you captured within the image, and make its best guess at making those crisp and clean. And effectively, the degree of sharpening that you apply will... It won't give you focus, but it'll give you an appearance of focus because it's just tightening the edges of the pixels. The reason that you would do it originally is that sharpening would be done in the dark room, but it would be done in the dark room of the firm that were doing the printing for you. And any printer worth their salt now will ask for unsharpened material, and they will do the sharpening for you. So I've got a Tame guy a few miles away in Tamworth, and he's a real quality old printer, and I give him all the images for copy unsharpened, and he will do all the sharpening to match his printing equipment, because he knows how much he needs to sharpen that image to make it look right on the printed output. And the same would apply then if you're talking about things like photo machines. If you go down to your local photo lab, so a proper photo laboratory if they still exist, then you would take it an unsharpened, and you would ask them to sharpen it relative to their printout equipment. Now, if you've got some bloke who's bought himself a colour photocopier, he ain't going to ask you for that. And if you say, I've sent it through and sharpened, can you sharpen it for your machine? And he gives you a blank look, then it's just a bloke who's having a go. But most of the time now, I sharpen most of my stuff before I send it off, and a lot of times I'm really pissed off at that because I have to guess at what I think I need to sharpen it for the output. So you'll sharpen quite heavily for the web, so maybe you'll do 100% at 3 pixels or something like that, which means that it'll sample the 3 pixels around each one and presume whether that applies to that pixel or does not apply to that pixel, and then give you the edge from that. Or you probably want to go up to, if you're talking about outputting at photo machines in your local Costco or CVS or something like that, you might want to be a little bit less, maybe only a 1 pixel sharpen. But it's basically taking what you've got and making it look crisper so that when it's printed out, when it goes out in its finished format, it looks correct rather than looking a little bit blurred and a little bit soft. And also, if you have been unlucky and you've shot a moving image and it doesn't quite look pucker, or you've got something where you've moved slightly after you've done your partial lock and it's got an out of focus to it, you can kind of just pull it back a little bit. But basically, you've got to start on the premise that if you shot it out of focus, it's out of focus.
Pucker meaning nice, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
It's now used in colloquial Indian languages.
I'm just translating because I remember hearing it from the chef, Jamie...
Oliver.
Oliver.
Oliver, yeah. Pucker tucker.
I would say one thing I'd say to Robert, who wrote in the question, is sharpen by eye, and when it looks right at 100%, then say yes to it. But if you're looking at the correct use of sharpening within professional output in printing and photography, I think that's a dead art, actually, to be honest.
Oh, I couldn't. Oh,
No, I mean, most of the places that I go, it is a dead art, mate. You go to some printers and you say, you know, what do I need to do to sharpen? They haven't got a clue what you're talking about.
I completely agree that people that should know how to do it don't know how to do it. But I would say, personally, I think Photoshop and all the rest of it, the most important thing you can learn to do properly is proper sharpening.
100% agree.
Yeah.
Absolutely the most important. Selective sharpening is the most important tool that Photoshop, the bigger versions of Photoshop give you, is the best way. I mean, I would say, at the very least, if you've taken portraiture and you want to do a bit of sharpening, if you're not sure what you're going to do, I'm pretty sure in all the Photoshops you can mask or you can select. Select an area or make a layer or whatever it is and just sharpen the most important bits, maybe the eyes and maybe a couple of things like that. Because of over-sharpening destroys a picture worse than not sharpening at all. But if you can do selective sharpening, then that will make the difference between a nice picture into a spectacular picture. I would say that's the most important thing you could learn.
Funny thing about it, it scares the hell out of me, actually, but it sounds like that's what I'll be doing over the weekend.
Well, I think sharpening. The point that Alex is making there is you can really screw an image up if you get it wrong. But the beauty you've got now is that before you had to sharpen in a darkroom, and that's where it got really tiresome because, yeah, you weren't screwing your original negative. You were screwing your printout. But you know, that took a long time to do. And if you were getting it wrong after wrong after wrong, it was soul-destroying. At least now you've got undo, or you make a duplicate layer and you sharpen the duplicate layer and not screw up your original background image.
Yeah, you've got the experience there, don't you, Ewan?
Was a brief point that I wanted to add too, because the guy said he was using Photoshop Elements, and there's a difference between sharpen. There is and this is true for Photoshop as well. But there's a sharpen command and unsharp mask, and I think that Ewan and Alex are both talking about unsharp mask, which is maybe some people regard as a bit more of a professional tool, since it requires some adjustment, and the sharpen command by itself just applies kind of a generic setting and is a little more limited. There's not really any adjustment. So
is it kind of an automatic thing?
Right.
Yeah, but I think the basic sharpen tool has got a slight bit of built-in intelligence into it.
Oh, Smart Sharpen's brilliant.
Oh, Smart Sharpen's good, but the basic sharpen tool has a form of Smart Sharpen in it.
Yeah.
It, and also you've got the Sharpen More, which normally comes with the basic Sharpen, which, you know, Sharpen does the intelligent thing. Sharpen More just whacks whatever you can on top of it.
Overdrive.
So you do have the options.
I usually find myself that I always use Unsharp Mask just because, you know, I can really control how it works.
Yeah. I was going to say, Robert, basically what we're telling you, it's okay to sharpen, tread very thinly, though, and be careful. That's what the undo button is for.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Next question, guys. I might actually start with Chris on this. Read it out. Hi, fellas. Have you listened to your advice over the last few months? I have decided to get adventurous with my photography, and I've tried to do some shots of colored water dropped into water in an old fish tank, which I have. I have tried doing it in the natural light with some flash units I have, but I've still not got very good results. Mostly the water never looks clean, and if I add light, I tend to get overexposed images. When I reduce the exposure, I get gray water again. I know it's a lot to ask with very little information, but do you guys have any tips on how to achieve what I want? And that comes from Gary. Chris, do you think you can help Gary out with that?
There's a few things that come to mind right away. The first is to control your background. So whatever you're setting this container of water on, you know, you can probably get a fairly inexpensive roll of background paper from your local photography supply store or something like that nature, and get just like the nice pure white paper to start with. Clean the tank really well that you're using, and use distilled water. So it doesn't have any kind of, you know, if you're using tap water, there's always going to be some kind of impurity. So no matter how you light it, you're going to get some odd reflections off the minerals or whatever's inside there. those are two things that come off the top of my head right away.
Yeah, no, the one thing I was going to say was we had a bit the other week about lighting backgrounds, and I think the thing that you've got there with the beauty of what Chris is saying is get yourself a nice high white paper and then light the paper. So instead of trying to control your exposure with light at the subject, control it with reflection off the background, because then it'll be you've got far more control, and you've also got a better opportunity of getting the result that you want. And I'm going to clean the tank.
I love that, actually, yeah.
And the other thing I thought was perhaps
seemed obvious, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
Obvious is good, dude. Don't worry.
Get the fish crap out.
Yeah. Try curves as well in Photoshop afterwards. That can make a huge difference to water. I remember taking a picture of some penguins that were submerged through a tank, and the water looked green to the naked eye. I put it through curves and had a play around, and all of a sudden the green disappeared and penguins appeared out of nowhere, and they were crystal clear as well. You know, so it can be just a tone and curves issue within Photoshop that can help you out. So
yeah, I think the water is kind of like a very narrow dynamic range, and that's why curves would help especially.
Yeah, I think you've got to look at the angle that the light's coming into the water as well, because it's just like almost like a polarizing issue. You know, you get it in one direction and it'll refract a completely different way than another direction. Mess with your light position.
Yeah, just to say, I mean, I shoot quite a few things in Perspex boxes, artworks and various things. Right. I would never use flash, and basically what I'd do is you set up the shot to get the most even lighting you possibly can with reflectors and backgrounds, and set that up and get that right first. Don't worry about your water drops or anything else. Get your exposure right for the background you want. Take a few test shots, get the lighting right so you've got a lovely even water. When you've got that right, then start playing around taking your shot with the your inks or your water droplets, because afterwards curves will sort out that perfectly. You can just, if you're not quite happy with a tone or whatever of the water drop, fix the water drop, not the background. You know, if you get the background right, get that right, play around with it for an hour, get it right, and then everything else will fall into place very, very easily. But it's all going to be constant lighting, not flash, not playing around with levels. Get that spotlights, reflectors, and background. Get that right, and it will be perfectly fine.
And Windex. Don't forget the Windex.
Well, you know, I just as a point, a serious point, quite often when I photograph things, I photograph a lot of paintings and they've got glass on. The worst thing that ever happens to me is when someone comes along and tries to clean that glass. Because as bad as it looks before it's cleaned, once you start cleaning it, unless it's absolutely spotless, it looks terrible. If it's got a thin layer of dust or something there for 50 years, it's an awful lot better picture than trying to clean the thing and not getting it 100% right.
I'm that guy, Alex. I'm that guy that walks through and says, ooh, it's a little dirty.
Yes, we'll just leave it.
Sorry. Last question, guys. It's actually just to all three of us. Sorry, Chris. Recently, I took some pictures at an expo, and some are really good images, I'm pleased to say. I think they would make good images for the event organizers and stock image. In the images, there are people shown, and I wanted to know if this would stop me from selling the pictures without having a release form from them. Or must I blur them out? Thanks. It comes from Ron, who's listening to us in Michigan. We talked about this before, guys, about licensing rights and all of this stuff. We'll get everybody's point. We've got two sides of the world covered. We'll start with you, Ewan. What should he do about this, or is he okay?
I think he's focusing too much on the people. The problem he's going to have is the events people, because they would probably have put a restriction on access for photography. It's not a public area, it's a private venue by technicality. So he may not have a license to have shot those images in the first place. So I'd approach the event organizer and see if they mind him selling them first. As far as the people are concerned, they've got no right to privacy there. They were at a public event, even though it may be on a private premises. And unless they were in some secluded corner or a private booth of something, that kind of description, where they could have expected higher degrees of privacy, they've lost it entirely. So no, he can sell the image for stock. But it's the event organizer I think he should be focusing on rather than the people.
Cool deal. Anything to add, Alex, before we pop on over to the other side of the pond?
No, British law says if it's public, it's public. Tough.
Mm.
You know, but again, as you said, if you haven't got a license to take it in a private event, be very careful. Frame the question when you ask them is, if I had happened to have done this, because if you tell them you have done it, they can actually demand that you give them the images.
And then they can use them for themselves.
Exactly. So frame your question very carefully.
Chris, anything different over there, or is that pretty much the same?
It's pretty similar. I think that the concern, at least from what I'm familiar with here in the States, is it depends on the final use of the image. So so if you're going to sell it for stock or for marketing or advertising, typically a model release is required. If it's going to be used for like educational purposes, photo, you know, like journalistic purposes, illustrative purposes. So, for instance, the expo itself might have a website talking about the expo, and there's pictures of people at the expo. That wouldn't require a model release. But I think there's kind of a fine line with depending on the commercial use of it, when it requires a model release. And in some cases, it's more like just kind of a cover your ass move, just to make sure.
No, that's good. Good advice. Mm-hmm. If you can get it, then get it. But I mean, yeah. I think you've got to look at if you're using a say you shot a famous person in that crowd, then mm-hmm. then it's an entirely different thing, because there's a pseudo endorsement that, or there's a blatant endorsement of something, then that person, because of the notoriety that they have, has an ability to claim that it would be something that would require an extra license or release.
Good point. Yeah, basically, yeah, it is. I was going to say, just cover your butt. And I think he's also wanting to, it sounds like by his question, approach the event organizers as well. Apparently, he likes what he's taken. So definitely approach them. And if you do want to sell anything, get permission.
But I think Alex's point's really good there.
Yeah, don't, just say, you know, it. I was planning to take some pictures at your next expo. And what's your rules on taking them? Who owns the copyright and blah, blah, blah. Frame it that way. Don't tell them you've already done it.
Good point. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. You kind of put yourself in hot water and they have the loophole.
Yeah,
you're in trouble.
Yeah. Your questions, as you can see, we do them every week. We'd love to get yours, and send them in. Simple to do. BagelTechPhoto@gmail.com, and we will get to your questions. It may not be next week's or the next week's, but we will eventually get to them. We get a lot of questions every week, and we love to answer them. We also do a little thing on the show called the cheap thingies, and I know you've got one, Ewan. Does anybody else have a cheap thingy this week other than a SCSI port for you, Alex?
Exactly. Use what you got and don't buy new stuff.
Chris, you got anything you want to share with us?
Cheap thingy.
Or do you want to think about it and we'll come back to you?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do that. We'll get Ewan's in first. Ewan, cheap thinking. What you got?
Mine came up because of a conversation with a guy this week. I've been at a guy that's got a car renovation plant. You know, he does restoring and that kind of stuff. And I was taking pictures and I said, you know, I'm going to shoot this freehand because I think it would look a bit more edgy. You know, the natural light that's coming through the skylights in the roof give it a better edge than if I'd put artificial up. And he said, how do you go about shooting, you know, still when you're using indoor from natural light? One of the things I said to him was, well, if you're at a party or something like that, you've got real low light and you're shooting at something like 1/20th or 1/10th of a second, more often than not, the thing that causes you the first initial problem is that you're actually depressing a shutter. So the physical movement of your finger by nature gives you some movement. So one of the ways around it is to put your camera onto burst mode if you've got it, brace yourself and depress the shutter and shoot 4 or 5 images straight away, because the chances are the first one will be blurred because of the finger movement, but you've taken that away from the second, third, fourth and fifth images. So there's a good chance, if you've stayed reasonably still, one of those is going to pop out as being at reasonable quality. There you go.
I've used that technique myself a lot because I do a lot of low light shooting.
Yeah, I know you do a lot of event stuff, don't you? Pop concerts mm-hmm. and so on, yeah. Good one. Thanks. Have you got anything, Chris?
I do. I don't know if this has ever been mentioned before, but something that I do a lot is make my own reflectors. I mean, you can like the nice little pop-out ones are nice to carry around sometimes, but, you know, when I'm at home shooting... I just like to use large sheets of bright white foam core by itself, or even sometimes, you know, you can cover it with like some wadded up tin foil, you know, give it a nice uneven surface, and that gives it an even brighter reflection. But I make reflectors at home all the time.
Mm-hmm. There's lots of materials around.
You can make a lot of, I mean, if you get a nice big sheet of foam core from like a art supply store, you know, for a few dollars, you can cut it down to different sizes. And depending on, you know, if you're using tabletop type photography or if you're doing a portrait, you can make a little bit bigger one. But it's cheap, and I always have whatever size I need.
Yeah, one of the things I've used as well is camera bag foam. If you look at the grey pimple stuff, that's really good for absorbing light as like a black, especially if you use the dimpled side of it. Mm-hmm. They can work quite well as negative for that.
Yeah, good point. Could I just add something? Just coming back on what Kyle said about, you know, Alex saying something about a SCSI port. The truth is, I mean, what brought this on is I'm using a scanner that I was about to throw away just because I hadn't turned it on for ages. There is a good point in saying, especially as us photographers are hoarders and various things, time to time, just go through all the stuff you've not looked at for a long, long time, because there's bound to be something in there that you can use and something that will maybe reignite an idea or reignite something else in you. So, you know, do go through all your old stuff, because we've all got bags and cupboards full of stuff that we haven't looked at for years. Have a look at it, and you might find that that's compatible with something you've got.
I think it's a good point there, because, I mean, I've noticed myself in just like cooking dinner at night, there's certain phases through my married life where I've cooked certain types of food. And Sharon and I have sat down and I've said to her, what was it I used to cook with pork? You know, and she's saying, I can't remember. And that's exactly what photography is like. There's a technique that you fell in love with for a period of years, and then you kind of forget it and it becomes obsolete. So that's a great point, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, I fall foul of that all the time. I think I've got about 8 camera bags next to me at the moment, because when I had a big failure of a camera the other week, I had to pull out a load of stuff to find out what I had that might just do the job. And I was like, wow, I've forgotten about that camera. I've forgotten about this. And I've been playing for the last couple of weeks like a kid in a toy shop. And it's like I've got all these new presents, and it's been fantastic. Mm. So just have a look for your cupboard. You'd be amazed what you'll find.
That's a great bit of advice.
Yeah. It's always nice to come back. And sometimes by looking through that, I mean, with anything, but like coming back, you realized, oh, yeah, I used to do that. Or it kind of brings certain passions, or maybe it just make you want to go out in the front yard and take something, you know, that you used to use with that lens or something. In fact, yeah. That's the cheapest tip of all time, but it's probably the best one.
Yeah!
You use the stuff you've already bought. Before we get out of here, we got to thank UK2. They are the ones that keep this podcast alive, the entire network alive, and we would be literally in the fish tank with all the fish crap without them. They really are our lifeline. Every week, I don't know how many terabytes we've gone through this month. We're approaching the end of the month.
3 again.
Oh my God, 3 terabytes again. So basically without them, we'd all have second or 3 or 4 mortgages on our homes. So please go to bageltechnews.com. Go down to the bottom of the webpage there. You'll see their emblem, UK2. Click the click-through. That's really what we're asking you to do. That way they know we are sending you. And then once you get over there, have a look around. They got some great deals. We've got a deal right now with a VPS server, which is, I believe our code is it BagelTech? Correct, Ewan?
Yeah, just to use the VPS server for BagelTech and co-location services, you get a month free of charge. So that's got to be good.
And they put you in a draw for an iPad too as well.
No, you actually get a free iPad too with the co-location.
Oh, you get a free. Okay, so that's the one you actually get a free iPad. See, it's a win-win deal, yeah. So, I can never say enough about UK2.net. I also want to point out, too, he's a guy that's on our Mac show all the time, which is Don McAllister. And he's given us a really great discount to pass on to you guys for Screencasts Online. Go on over, again, to bageltechnews.com. You'll see there for Screencasts Online, 50% off. If you sign up through us, and I know Don would appreciate it. Great tutorials on Mac, and most photographers do use Mac, so I'm sure there'd be something on there that anybody really could use.
Most good ones, anyway.
They're the only decent ones.
Chris, it has been a pleasure having you on. Have we scared you away?
Thanks for having me.
Coming back.
Sure, yeah, I'd love to.
You're a regular, mate. You just bought it.
Bourbon and all.
Oh, great, yeah.
where can people get a hold of you, man?
I'm on arstechnica.com, five to six days a week. So, you can see me there. I'm also on Twitter at Foresmac, Foresmac.
I've been trying to follow you on Twitter and I couldn't find you. Make a note I could remember.
Please do. And I'm going to follow him in a second too. Speaking of Twitter and that, all things are like that. Ewan, where can we get a hold of you?
You can get me at ewanrankin.co.uk for commercial site and that kind of stuff. And I'm on Twitter at Ewan Rankin or at Bagel Tech News. I'm also having a chat with Don at the moment. I've done a few screencasts for, simple Photoshop use just in Essentials. So I think I'm going to shove some screencasts out as well under the guise of Bagel Tech Photo. And don't forget, of course, the Bagel Tech Photo group on Flickr. So flickr.com/groups/BagelTechPhoto. And you've only got a couple of days left to do your photo assignment for alternative covers. And mine is going to be posted on Sunday, so you better get a move on.
Are you talking to me?
I'm talking to everybody. Because this month's assignment is rethinks or retakes on classic album covers. As provided by Mr. Fox. So
I'm so busy getting the cardboard cutouts in for Sergeant Pepper, but don't worry, I'll be done by Sunday.
Good. So Chris, you've only got a few days to get yours in.
Okay.
No pressure. And last but not least, of course, Alex G. Fox, where can we get a hold of you?
Just put an @ in front of Alex G. Fox and you'll find me on Twitter somewhere.
Good deal. Guys, it's been a fun show. Thank you so much for coming along. You can find me on Twitter, if you so well please, twitter.com/KyleSwagger. We will be back again next week, as always, with some more great of your photography questions. Of course, whatever photography news is available out there, we will bring it to you. We will see you next week, right here on Bagel Tech Photo.
Bandwidth and hosting for Bagel Tech Photo is provided by UK2.net. Web hosting for everyone.